For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
I had an experience some years ago in Japan. We were asked to go there, and we did a series of discussions on Christ and comparative religions. That was the reason for the conference, and that's why I went. But while we were there, the host that brought us in is a seminary professor there, and he also has a little group that he meets with for Bible study. And it was just fun. We got there right after Christmas was over, and driving through Tokyo, there was all kinds of Merry Christmas and nice Anglo-looking Santa Clauses and snowmen and stuff like that. And we were talking about just the whole kind of interaction of Christianity and culture. And he said, well, let me give you a little insight into where things are here. He said, right before Christmas, they went around their neighborhood and they were inviting people to their Bible study because, you know, it's Easter Christmas. And you know, surely people will think, well, you know, if I'm going to go to a church once in my life, this would be the appropriate time to come or whatever. What they found, interestingly, was people would be like, why would I go to a Bible study on Christmas? And it was evident in talking to people that they had this picture of what Christmas was that had absolutely nothing to do with Christianity. They didn't know it was a Christian holiday, is what I'm trying to say. And so that was pretty interesting, but it made me think, in our own culture, which is very multi-ethnic and increasingly so, and also increasingly kind of cut off from any kind of biblical literacy and biblical past, that I wonder what people think this like on the street today when they think Easter. Maybe what they think of is Nintendo games. Or they might think, yeah, Easter, kind of familiar with that. Oh, I know. It's where the Easter bunny dresses up like the Santa Claus, or is kind of like maybe Halloween. That bunny, wow. You know, think about a 6'8" bunny with your baby on it. And you must be thinking either that's super creepy, or that bunny must be really important. And so you turn on the news and find that indeed he is a very important person. He's sponsoring these athletic events like we have on Thanksgiving. Even has his conversation with the president, who's about to introduce the real most important person in the world, the Easter Bunny. And so just again, sort of looking on, we wonder, what is this really about? And tonight, what we need to do is move back in history a bit. We need to ask ourselves the question, what is the ancient origin of this important celebration? Yes, that's taken right off a Grecian urn. That's what that is. It's just kind of funny how we take what is at the core of it, the claim of it, the most important possible thing you could ever imagine, and turn it into the things that we turn it into. So we want to take a couple of steps back tonight, and we want to look primarily out of a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to a bunch of friends that he had in the Greek city of Corinth. He wrote this letter at about 50 AD, and here's what he says in summarizing the Christian message. He says, I delivered to you of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. And so I've underlined these three things: the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Paul is wanting to say that that is at the heart of it. He says, the first importance. This is really the core. This is what Christianity really is all about. And I want to explore this a little bit and kind of remove the images of the Easter Bunny and all of those fun things and kind of get at what Paul is asserting here, his claim. And why reasonable people 2,000 years later accept this as true. And not only as true, but as the foundation of their own lives, as the reality that has transformed their life, and which is why, by invitation, many of us are here tonight. The whole issue of Jesus and history is an important one. What do we know about the Jesus of history? Even from the most ardent skeptics, we know from Bart Ehrman, for instance, who is a very well-known atheistic historian. He wrote a book this year called Did Jesus Exist? And here's what he says about this question, did Jesus exist? He said, in Did Jesus Exist, historian Bart Ehrman, is taken right off the liner, vigorously defends the historical Jesus, identifies the most historically reliable sources for the best understanding of Jesus' mission and message, and offers a compelling portrait of the person at the heart of the Christian tradition. Okay. There was in the first century, almost certainly from 4 BC to 33 AD, a man named Jesus from Nazareth who lived, who was executed as a Roman criminal under Pontius Pilate. And of this, there is absolutely no serious historic question. That issue is resolved. Jesus existed. Jesus died. The attestation of these facts bleeds far over the banks of the Bible itself into the core of both Roman and Jewish history of the time. The real question that we want to explore here is this other claim, that he died, that he was buried, is without serious historic question. If that's something you say, well, I don't think there was such a person as Jesus. Well, you're going to be hard-pressed to find any knowledgeable historian that agrees with you. It is a fact that he existed and basically lived the kind of life described by the four Gospels. The real question is, did he, in fact, raise from the dead? And this is what we want to explore. Of course, this is what Easter is all about. It is the affirmation that not only did Christ die on the cross, but 3 days later, the tomb in which he was entombed was empty and that he himself was risen from the dead. An amazing claim. The biggest mystery of all, what happens at death? Is death it? Or is there something more? And that's what we need to explore here. Paul says it's of first importance. He says there is no Christianity without the resurrection of Christ from the dead. That's at the heart of it. Jesus himself says in John 11, verse 25, after raising his friend Lazarus from the dead, he says, I am the resurrection and the life, and he who believes in me will live even if he dies. And then he says, do you believe that? It's interesting. Here's an opportunity tonight, you know, just to kind of sit back and really think about this thing. Jesus makes the claim, he who believes in me will live even if he dies. That's a claim that he's making about everybody who believes in him. And the proof that this claim is more than just an empty promise, the resurrection from the dead. So it seems to me that this is a pretty relevant question for us, because here is something that I can predict with about 100% accuracy. You're going to die. I'm going to die. We're mortal. We've got a time on this earth, maybe a little longer than we would have thought, maybe a little shorter, who knows. But we're all going to find ourselves at that place where life is coming to a close. And it begs this question, is this it? Or is there something more? And how can I know? That's a very important question on a lot of levels. But Jesus makes this confident claim. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. So I just want to urge us to an open mind about this claim that Jesus makes and the claim that it makes on your life and mine. The resurrection, understood from the biblical perspective, authenticates the teaching of Christ. That's really important. Jesus has made it really clear And we can read about this in the Gospels, that the resurrection of the dead is at the core of what makes us believe in the truth of what he did, what he said. The predictions of Christ, for instance, in Mark chapter 8, verses 31 and 32. Jesus began to teach his disciples that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and after 3 days again raised from the dead. And he was stating the matter plainly. I underline that because it's like, oh, raised from the dead. You know, Peter goes on to say in chapter 9, verse 31, when Jesus brings it up again, he goes, is this a parable, Jesus? What do you mean raising from the dead? What's that all about? Some figure of speech or whatever. And so this is why it's so important that Mark adds this comment. He was stating the matter plainly. This is not some kind of, well, rising from the dead is kind of like waking up the next day anew and afresh, and it's a brand new day. It's not what he means. He means literally resurrected from the dead. He stated the matter plainly and repeatedly. He says that he'll be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes and be killed. That's a matter of historic record. We know that that's the case. And so the question with the cross is, what happened and how does that relate to the issue of the resurrection? What happened at the cross? Was it the death of some misunderstood martyr who was confused about who he was and gave himself for a cause that just ended up not being understood by anyone? He died a tragic figure, or no? Is he the fulfillment of the whole Old Testament's hope and picture of what God would do when he entered into the world? This is the claim of the Bible. In Isaiah chapter 53, verses 8 and following, I want to just give you a little selection of this. The piece that I'm going to read right here from Isaiah 53 was written 700 years before the time of Christ. We have hard copies of this statement, of this prophecy in the Dead Sea Scrolls datable to about 160 BC. We know that it was written hundreds of years before the time of Christ because the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible was done at 200 BC and it includes this passage. There is absolutely no question that this was written hundreds of years before the time of Christ and describes exactly the mission of God's Messiah. It says he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression, the failures, the moral failures of my people to whom the stroke was due. It says my servant will justify the many as he will bear their iniquities. He'll bear their sin. God intends to send, it says, his servant. It's a technical expression that Isaiah uses for Messiah, the anointed one by God who's going to carry out the mission of God. The mission of Messiah is to come into the world and to die a death that you and I deserve. He dies our death. He bears our iniquity. We've got a problem with God. There's a barrier between ourselves and God. And that barrier is that we've each gone our own way. We're into doing our thing on our terms, not recognizing that we are a created being and that we owe our lives to a God who created us and designed us to live life his way. So he gave us freedom to do our own thing, but he didn't protect us from the consequences of the abuse of that freedom, which is the corruption of the human soul and an alienation that exists between ourselves and God. And if that God, as the Bible describes it, is a morally perfect being, then we've got a moral problem with him as well. There's an issue of justice involved. The good news that the Bible declares and that Jesus himself declares is that God has not left us with a situation where it's like, okay, you're all screwed up and you're distant from me. That part's a fact. Look at society today. Does that look like the model that a good God would create? It's pretty broken. Look at human history, the barbarity of man against man. There's something fundamentally wrong with all of us. That's something that every religion and every philosophy, regardless of culture or time, has affirmed. All religion is a system in which a person can deal with their problem of guilt before God through a series of disciplines, the observance of rites, promises to do better, all of these things. That is what religion does. It's what I do for God. Whether it's the Eightfold Path or the Five Pillars or the Four Noble Truths or whatever system it is, all religion is a system of our making ourselves acceptable to God. All of them, except this one. The biblical teaching that it isn't us that makes the initiative towards God to fix our broken system, to fix our broken lives. It's God who moves toward us. It's God who's moved toward you in Christ to do something that you cannot do on your own, which is to deal with your guilt and your alienation from God. That's what he did in the cross. That's what it means when it says that my servant will justify the many because he will bear your and my sin. That's the promise. Now, in the psalm, Psalm 49 is a pretty sweet psalm. The psalmist, this is David speaking, he says, no man can by any means redeem his brother or give God a ransom for him, for the redemption of his soul is costly, and he should cease trying forever, that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. David is making this point. Okay, I love my wife. I would do anything for her. Let's say I had the power to go before God and say, my wife is awesome, but she's a piece of work, that one. Where is she? There you go. Hi. Yes. She's all boogered up. But, I'll take the hit for her. I'll experience your judgment for her because I love her so much. David's like, well, you know, no one can really do that. Because why? Because the cost is too high. No human can pay for the sins of another as much as they might want to. And he said, we should just stop thinking about that now. Why? Because there is no human solution to the human dilemma. But then our psalmist goes on and he says in verse 15, but God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. God has the authority and God has the power to deal with the problem of human sin. And only God, according to the Old Testament. And that's the whole purpose of Messiah coming into the world, is to make that sacrifice on behalf of a guilty humanity. And that is why on the cross, as Jesus is breathing his last, John records that sour wine is put in front of him to quench his thirst, which doesn't really quench his thirst, it's more to mock him. And he says at that moment, it is finished. In the Greek, it's tetelestai. And he bowed his head and he gave up his spirit. Tetelestai, it's finished. That's a very important word and a very important proclamation that Jesus makes. Paul picks up on this proclamation in Colossians chapter 2, verse 13. He says, he made you alive with Christ, having forgiven all of our transgressions. He says, having canceled out the certificate of debt. That is the same concept that Jesus is breathing from the cross. The idea that Paul is describing in Jesus' cross is what he calls the certificate of debt. The certificate of debt is a rap sheet, right? You know what a rap sheet is? It's like, here's your list of crimes. And in the Roman world, when you were thrown in prison, on the prison door, your certificate of debt. Here's why Alex is in prison. And all the things. Man, this dude's never getting out. Okay? Now, after a person has spent their sentence, that certificate of debt is written across an official Roman seal, tetelestai, paid in full, paid in full. And Paul is affirming what Jesus is affirming, that in the cross, as Jesus is breathing his last, he's making this incredible declaration to all who are guilty, paid in full. I've paid it all. There's nothing you can do to add or to diminish your standing before God if you receive the sacrifice that I'm making on your behalf. It's paid in full. Man, that's real good news. Paid not in part, not I'll meet you halfway, not for the things that you did years ago. Paid in full for the substance of your broken life. Christ pays the debt that you and I owe God. And it is not a partial payment. It is not a down payment. It is paid in full. That is awesome. That's what that's about. Well, here's another take. Is Christ enough? Okay, we're so glad that he died on the cross. Now what? Now I do the best I can, right? Now I just try harder. Do the right thing, as Spike Lee says. And that is great theology. That is actually taught in passages like this. The weighing that day is true, the judgment day. He whose scales are heavy, they will prosper. He whose scales are light, they have lost their souls. Oh, but that's not the Bible, is it? That's religion. That's the Quran. But that's oddly the image that so many of us have of what is going to happen before we go before God. The scales of justice will teeter as our good deeds and our bad deeds are hanging in the balance, moving ever so slowly toward that fateful moment when it goes one way or another. And when Chip is thinking to himself, oh man, I know I kind of blew it there, blew up at my neighbor. I wonder if that's going to be a problem. But I was really nice to Paul. That's got to be worth something. Boom. Oh. I told you should never have said that. That's the essentially religious view of what happens before God. It's what they all teach, except Jesus Christ. Not paid in part, paid in full. The whole deal paid for. Not religion, not the scales of justice. We'll lose every time with the scales of justice. Well, here's the question then. How can we know that the cross accomplished what Christ claims, what Paul claims that it accomplishes? That sounds like great news. Thanks so much. But how do I know? How do I know that his death was for me and was adequate to deal with my problems with God? The claim of the scripture is because in satisfying God's justice for human sin, Christ, with his infinite nature as God, absorbed God's infinite wrath in a finite moment of time and was resurrected from the dead to prove the adequacy of that sacrifice. That's where the resurrection comes in. That's how we know. You say to yourself, well, that sounds a little bit too good to be true. Really? Well, let's think about this a little bit. A lot of us have maybe through courses that we've taken in college, perhaps, or weird things on the History Channel, somewhere between UFO files and whatever kind of weird stuff they have on there, familiar with the thought that, you know, the Bible is just a bunch of ancient myths and legends that were compiled over a period of time. Yes, they include this story of the resurrection, but who could believe such a thing made up by primitive people with this primitive story of, of death and resurrection, certainly not a modern, scientifically oriented person like me and you. That's the charge. That's kind of the character of our day. But I want to say a couple things about the New Testament's description of the resurrection from Christ. First, from the standpoint of the literary style which is brought to us. Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, opens this way. He says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things that you've been taught." That's Luke's introduction to his gospel about the work of Jesus Christ and the teachings of Christ. Does that look like myth or legend? Look at how he's introducing it to us. "Having investigated everything carefully." That's not poetic. That's not a mythological story. It's something rooted in history, that here is this man who's gone back and he's investigated these things. Did they happen? According to the standards of Roman evidence, did they happen? He's writing them in a consecutive order. So there's this linear unfolding of events in the life of Christ for the purpose that you might know the exact truth about the things that you've been taught. So Luke is not just, as some have said, a compilation of stuff that was written maybe a century after the time of Christ or whatever, but is written on the basis of careful evidence collecting and based upon numerous eyewitness accounts. It's not an urban legend, not just some sort of a story. He's gone to people who said, "Yep, I was there. Yep, I heard him teach. Yep, I was there when he died on the cross. And yes, I saw the resurrected Christ." Eyewitnesses. Peter's testimony, very important. Those who were from the beginning eyewitnesses. And Peter goes on to tell us in 2 Peter 1, this is toward the end of Peter's own life. He says, "We didn't follow cleverly devised myths." We're not making up stories that were handed down over decades and so forth. "We didn't follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." Eyewitnesses. We saw it. We beheld it. We were there. And very importantly, the time frame in which the New Testament was written eliminates the possibility that these are just myths and collected stories that evolved over many decades. The Gospels almost certainly were completed by 70 AD for reasons that relate to the destruction of Jerusalem and of the temple. So most historians will place it before that time. But even if we said, there's been so much talk about the Gospels and can we believe them and stuff like that, I would like to suggest that there is a way that we can view the factual nature of the resurrection from Christ without even going to the Gospels. Assessing the evidence can be rooted first in sources outside the Bible that lead the way to this, and then an examination of texts of the New Testament that no serious historian questions. Sources outside the Bible include the Roman historian Tacitus, who makes this point. He says, Christus, who again historians universally recognize as a reference and maybe the first reference to Christ, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. So there's the historical fact of the crucifixion from the Roman official standard. Suetonius, another Roman historian, says that since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Christus, he expelled them from Rome in 49 and 50 AD. That here the proclamation about Christ had come all the way to Rome. If Christ died in 33 AD, we're talking about 16 years later. making such an impact that it came to the attention of the emperor himself and caused the kicking out of all the Jews because of the controversy surrounding Christ. Something's going on that requires an explanation. Let's think about the biblical evidence here. We're going to look at 1 Corinthians 15, where we started, in just a minute. And I want to make a couple of citations from the most hostile possible sources of biblical scholarship. The Anchor Bible Commentary was written a number of years ago by historians who really are operating from an atheistic point of view. They don't believe in the supernatural and therefore reject the claims to the supernatural made in the Bible and in anything else. But what they are prepared to say is this about 1 Corinthians. They said, among New Testament critical scholars, nobody questioned that Paul wrote these letters, 1 and 2 Corinthians, about 50 AD, 17 years after the ministry of Christ. Nobody questions that. He says the authenticity of 1 Corinthians was never questioned in ancient times, was challenged in the late 19th century only by a few Dutch and German scholars, and is assumed in our day by every responsible interpreter. In its style, vocabulary, and ideas are indubitably Paul's. Then they cite this letter of a second-generation church leader named Clement. First Clement, section 47, paragraph 1. A letter of the church at Rome to the church at Corinth, dated to 96 AD, that contains numerous quotations and allusions to this letter. So we even have primary source documentation for 1 Corinthians from the copies that we have of this letter. It's pretty amazing. The point is, nobody doubts that Paul wrote 1 Corinthians 15 or the basic historical reliability of the things contained within it. So what does he say? Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 5 to 8, that Jesus appeared after his resurrection to Peter, that's Cephas, then to the 12. And after that, he appeared to more than 500 at one time, most of whom remain until now. Then he appeared to James, that's his brother, then to all of the apostles, and then last of all, it says he appeared to me. So what's Paul doing? He's directly appealing to eyewitness testimony, and he's saying of these Corinthians who are questioning the historical, physical resurrection of Christ from the dead, they're questioning it because in the Greco-Roman thought world, the body doesn't matter. It's just the spirit that matters. And so why would God bother to resurrect a corpse? But Paul is saying, no, man, that has to happen because Christ predicted it. And that's proof that his teaching about himself is true. And so what's the evidence? The evidence is that he appeared to Peter, who by this time was recognized as a central figure in the early Christian movement and a follower of Christ from the beginning. Then he says to the 12, that is that inner circle of disciples that Jesus gathered around himself, including Thomas and others who fundamentally didn't believe that they had seen the resurrected Christ at first. Thomas is like, there's no way this story's true. That's why they call him Doubting Thomas. Until Jesus himself comes before Thomas and says, feel the holes in my hands and the wound in my side. Oh yeah, it's me. Wow, powerful. He says he appeared to more than 500. The early church was rooted in the teaching about Christ and his resurrection. The first people who are the subjects of this teaching are those who were in Jerusalem when all these things about Christ happened. And there are 500 of them that saw the resurrected Christ. And Paul is basically saying, you don't have to take my word for it. I mean, I wish you would, but I realize you might not. So here's what you should do. Go to Jerusalem. Because there's nearly 500 people there who are witnesses to this event and said, yep, I totally saw the resurrected Christ. Then it says he appeared to James, his skeptical brother, who thought he was basically insane. for making these claims of being the Messiah and so forth. And all the apostles. And then he says, last of all, he appeared to me. Why last of all? Well, because in succession chronologically, yeah, Paul did come in last. But more importantly, because Paul was a virulent persecutor of the early church. As a good Jewish rabbi, well trained by Gamaliel, the leading rabbi of his day, Paul viewed this Christian movement as a cancer on Judaism. And so he went out in persecution of it until the resurrected Christ personally appeared to Paul on the road between Jerusalem and Damascus, where Paul was going to round up more Jesus followers, have them arrested and executed. And so Paul had one of these depends moments in which he's on his way to round up and execute these people, only to have Christ appear right in front of him to say, Paul, why are you persecuting me? Well, who are you, Lord? He says, I am Jesus whom you're persecuting. Oh, that's a wake-up call. And it changed his life. And now it's like, all this stuff is true. And he began looking again back into the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament. It's like, oh my God, why have I never noticed this picture of God's Messiah before? But there it is. Amazing. So even the one who is persecuting the church finds himself utterly convinced. These people are convinced, not in the abstract sense that someone might win or lose an argument. Or be like, oh yeah, well, whatever, okay, you're probably right. These are people who are accepting the belief in the resurrection of Christ from the dead, beholding it with their own eyes, interacting with Jesus numerous times over a period of 40 days, and are convinced to the extent that they're willing to pay the price of their testimony with their life. Is Paul making this story up, or Peter? For what possible motivation? People die for lies all the time, and especially religion is a great source of getting people whipped up to lay down their life for something that's just not true. It's the will of God that I blow up this building or whatever. Really? Yeah, I just feel it. Nobody dies for what they know to be a lie. People will die for lies, but not for what they know to be lies. And certainly not in the numbers that we see represented in this important historical text that even critics don't doubt. And so that's an important piece, eyewitness testimony. Then Paul says that Christ was executed according to the scriptures, and that he was resurrected again according to the scriptures. So he's turning now to the Old Testament to say, if you don't believe the witnesses that you can go and ask, go back and read for yourself what the Old Testament itself teaches. I delivered to you of first importance what I received, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. That he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. According to what scriptures? Psalm 16 and a number of other ones come to mind. Here, David, King David, writing 1000 B.C., says to God, you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to undergo decay. This is interesting. The expression Holy One, as we see it used in Isaiah chapter 41, verse 14, Jesus uses it also in Mark 1, verse 24. Well, actually, it's used of him in Mark 1, verse 24. Holy One is another of those terms used in the Old Testament for the Messiah. And David is saying, speaking in the first person on behalf of the Messiah, saying, the Holy One of yours is not going to undergo decay. That's not what's going to happen to his body. Now, Peter in Acts chapter 2, giving a speech on this passage, says, brethren, I can confidently say to you regarding our patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us today. Do we wonder, was he writing about himself or someone else? Let's go to David's tomb and open it and see if his bones are still there. That's what Peter's basically arguing. Well, there was no question about that because everyone knew that that was the case. Peter goes on, he says, because he was a prophet and knew God had sworn to him with an oath to seat his own descendant on the throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of Christ. He was neither abandoned to Hades, the afterworld, the underworld, whatever, nor did his flesh suffer decay. He's just arguing from the testimony of the Old Testament itself. The Holy One, the God's Messiah, yes, will die, but his body will not undergo decay because he'll be resurrected from the dead. Well, there are serious implications then. Paul goes on to say, the scriptures teach this. The testimony of multiple scores of witnesses teach this. He says, but let's think about this and really kind of work our way through the implications. He says, if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is vain. If Christ has not been raised from the dead, your faith is worthless. You're still in your sins. If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. That's what you call understanding the implications of what you're talking about. Okay? Paul was not some pious pontificator of religious ideas to get a following. Paul is saying the scriptures teach it. He's saying that the testimony of multiple witnesses testify to it, including my own. And let me just tell you, in case you don't wonder about this, if I'm in my right mind, let me tell you that if what I'm saying to you about the resurrection is false, then everything that I've taught to you is false. Our teaching is vain. It's pointless to say that there's a good God there that is prepared to forgive you because of what he did dying in your place. There's no reason for anyone to accept a message like that without the proof of the resurrection. Your faith is useless. And then he says, let's just eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Well, we began our discussion tonight with the point that the resurrection from the dead is the single most important event in human history. It demonstrates that there is more to our lives than this world. That there's more to what it means to be human than our life in this world. And Paul is making this very critical point. He says, look, if this is all there is, and the grave is the grave, what possible difference could it ever make? What you believe, what you did with your life, what anyone does, because nothing matters at that point. Who cares that you are a nice person to other nice people who are within hours, weeks, months, or years? Who cares of total extinction in which no one will know anything? And you will no longer be, and they will no longer be. And what possible meaning could there be in life other than just the arbitrary, made-up meanings of purpose that we say, well, I'm gonna live for a bigger paycheck. That's it. A house that's just a little bit larger than the one I grew up in. Or whatever it is. It's like, who cares? What difference does it make in the face of extinction? And you know, I think it's very easy in our culture to blind ourselves to the realities of the human condition because we are full, a culture full of distraction. And so asking these deeper questions just often just, it doesn't percolate down to where it really matters, where we're really thinking about it. We think we're pretty safe because we live in a safe place, a comfortable place, a predictable place, more or less, in terms of its safety and so forth. And so we don't feel at risk in any way. But we will. We will. And we are going to come to that place in our life at some point where we're asking this question, what possible difference does it make? And what happens to me when that electrocardiogram goes flat? And when everyone I know has the same thing happen to them and it's all over, what difference does it make? Whether I was this kind of fungus or that kind of fungus. I don't for a moment want to trivialize the importance of human life. Indeed, the biblical view of human life is the highest possible form of humanism. It says we're not merely complex biological machines, that we are actually transcendent beings created in the image of a personal God. That we are endowed with value and by virtue of who he has made us. That's why we can talk meaningfully about universal human rights, concepts of justice, because there is something absolutely valuable about every human being, because we are all equally image bearers of God. So there's something marvelous about human beings. And we know when we reflect on our own lives that there is something amazing about us. Amazing and broken. Amazing. Think of the things that human beings are able to accomplish. The creativity, the intelligence. Broken. What have we done with those things? Something. Both of these narratives are true. Of human experience, you know that these things are true. What gives those insights, that awareness substance, can only be the biblical view that yes, indeed, we are created in the image of a God from whom we are alienated. And this completes the story then, that God has done the work of reconciling us back to himself. That there is hope for purpose in this life, and an eternity in the presence of our Creator God who loves us. And how do we know that? Because it was predicted and because it came about in the person of Jesus Christ in 33 AD. And so this is kind of a sketch, an introduction to this very important topic. In the bookstore, we have an audio set called The Claims and Case for Christ that goes into these things in much more detail. There are several books, Evidence Unseen, The Case for Christ, and a number of other ones that kind of walk through evidence of this sort and on a much deeper level. Here's something that we just, when we think about Easter, let's get the Easter bunny off to the side. This is absolutely the most critically important thing that we could ever consider, isn't it? The possibility that we can be reconciled to God and that we can live beyond this life. That's something that I appeal to you, our friends, our guests here tonight, appeal to you. Check that out. See if your mind can be satisfied like so many others who are here tonight, so that we can put the weight of our life on a truth that really gives meaning and purpose to the whole shooting match that is this world.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.